Russia not only held the world's second-largest combined oil and gas reserves after Saudi Arabia, it was rising again as an oil producer and exporter. The political chaos and economic freefall that followed the collapse of the Soviet Union had caused Russia's oil production to fall from a high of more than 10 million barrels per day to about 6 million in 1996, about half of which was exported. As Putin took office on the last day of 1999, the industry had started to recover. Domestic consumption remained steady at about 3 million barrels per day, while exports were rising towards 7 million barrels per day and headed higher year by year. Most of the exports went to Europe, particularly to major economies such as Germany and the Netherlands. Yet Russian oil companies required new investment to reach their full production potential. The question was whether the Bush administration's push for a strategic oil partnership with Moscow after the Crawford dinner was at all realistic. Energy policy specialists in the Clinton administration hadn't thought so. They had been working on the same issues of energy cooperation with Russia throughout the late 1990s and had concluded, as a former White House official put it, that there was no discernible forward progress toward free market reform in the Russian oil sector under Putin. And the pendulum was swinging markedly against Western oil corporations that sought to own Russian reserves. If anything, from 1998 onward, there had been a very, very clear trend in Russian policymaking towards the U.S. of growing suspicion. The prize was so alluring that all of the major Western oil corporations persisted in Moscow nonetheless. For all of Russia's traps, unpredictable politics, mafia-like cliques in business and government who used murder and vendettas as negotiating tactics, prosecutors and judges subservient to shadowy powers, and a general absence of the rule of law, there was no other country on earth with so much oil that offered even the pretense of a capitalist-friendly opening. The numbers, the challenge of annual reserve replacement, the scale of Russia's holdings, argued for risk-taking. "How high can we fly?" Ambassador Vershbow, a career Foreign Service officer who had long studied Russia, asked in a cable to Washington a few months after the Crawford dinner. "Very high," he wrote. In developing a new strategic oil supply partnership in Moscow, the United States will need to be sensitive to the reaction of other energy-producing states, both in the region, i.e. the Caspian, and outside it, notably Saudi Arabia. Nonetheless, there was potential here to change global economics and politics. Strategic energy cooperation between Washington and Moscow, he wrote, is a deal. Russia improves along market lines and continues to divorce politics from commerce, and we help it get what it wants, markets, investment, and stature. But the deal can be broader. If successfully developed, it can serve as a paradigm as well as a driver for cooperation and market-driven behavior in a variety of sectors, a trend that will only help Russia integrate into the world economy. The United States owned no oil companies, however. To forge the deal Vershbow had in mind, the Bush administration would need to encourage America's largest private oil firms, particularly ExxonMobil and Chevron, to cooperate. Like a section of the American public, some in Putin's cabinet seemed to believe that the Bush White House made all the decisions for America's largest multinational oil companies, or vice versa. Putin himself seemed to understand how the American system worked, but some of his advisers projected what they knew about the Russian government's influence over its own oil and gas companies onto Washington, assuming it was the same there. German Greff, the Russian Minister of Economics, with whom Don Evans worked closely, would occasionally make points during their energy talks, suggesting that he thought that Evans or Bush had heavy influence on ExxonMobil. "Exxon writes their own checks, and they are accountable to their shareholders. They're not accountable to me," Evans told Greff. "I don't write their checks for them." Evans tried to explain that no matter what sort of agreement Washington and Moscow might forge about energy policy, no American oil company was likely to risk large amounts of investment capital if it feared that Russia's political and tax environment was unreliable. Evans quoted an aphorism often repeated by Bush's Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill. "Capital is a coward, and capital is not going to go any place that is unfriendly. His argument was undermined by the fact that all of the major oil companies, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, BP, Total, and Statoil, had already risked capital in Russia, even though its political economy was dangerous and highly unsettled. But it was Evans's job to make the case for Russian legal, tax, and policy reforms. On specific transactions, he encouraged the Russian government to deal directly with the American corporations, particularly ExxonMobil and Chevron, and he always spoke highly of Lee Raymond. ExxonMobil ran an office in Moscow, headed by a former Australian diplomat, Glenn Waller. Rosemary Forsyth, the former Clinton administration National Security Council analyst, also advised Raymond during ExxonMobil's talks in Russia after 2001. The corporation, as ever, believed it was better off handling things in Moscow on its own. Exxon operates independently, recalled Leonard Coburn, who worked at the Department of Energy on the Bush administration's Russian oil initiative. They think they can do it better than the U.S. government, and often they do. Occasionally, Lee Raymond might turn to Vice President Cheney or another very senior official to give the Russians a good kick in the pants, as Coburn put it, about a specific tax or policy stalemate in Moscow. Otherwise, the corporation negotiated in private. ExxonMobil owned one significant oil interest in Russia at the time the Bush administration made its push to deepen cooperation. In the chaotic last months of the Soviet Union, investment bankers retained by elements of the dying regime, presided over by Mikhail Gorbachev, shopped around all sorts of natural resource deals. Lee Raymond had authorized bids on an exotic project in Russia's far eastern territory, near Sakhalin Island, just above Japan. The project dated to the 1970s, when Japanese corporations had lent money to the Soviet Union in exchange for exploration rights. But the deal went nowhere until the Soviet Union began to crack up and finally split apart. In the early 1990s, Raymond called an old hand named Terry Kuntz, who was running Exxon's oil operations in Calgary, Canada, and asked him to go to Moscow to start to open the way in Russia. "Man, I thought you sent me to Siberia when I went to Calgary," Kuntz said. "No, I was just getting you warm."